Super. So since we just have half an hour, I'm going to dive right in. Sure. You know, with sort of a question that goes to the heart of, you know, why we're talking. You know, I'm a little bit of a novice when it comes to, you know, Force Design 2030. There are other reporters who kind of covered it a little bit more in depth than I have, but I took a little bit of a crash course, you know, over the last few days. So I guess to kind of ask you for, you know, a broad overview of the activities of the task force and how they, you know, how do they map with the Marine Corps concepts for stand-in forces and force design 2030? Since that's already underway.
It's a great question, and I'm glad we're talking about it. Because I think a couple of things in sequence, you know, kind of happened over the last 2 years here in the 2nd Marine Division. You know, as the commandant came out with force design about a year before I got here. You know, some of the things that were already in play were already happening here in division as we transitioned types of equipment, stood down certain elements of division, stood up others, and so that was already moving forward, and I inherited that when I got here. But when it got exciting was that we looked at two really programs that from force design that directly impacted us as far as experimentation. You know, one is called the Infantry Battalion Experiment 30 or IBEX 30, where one of our battalions looked at a new structure that we might adopt in the future of distributed ops, how we distribute our infantry forces over kind of a maritime littoral contact layer, and how would we operate. So we were exploring on that. And the second one was this reconnaissance and counter-reconnaissance. The term that kind of was brought forward in force design, probably misunderstood in a lot of ways, but really reconnaissance, counter-reconnaissance, look at it is how do we task organize Marine forces to support a fleet commander's requirements, primarily to increase the fleet commander's maritime domain awareness. And so really those two things were in action and happening, and we were doing some really good experimentation with both that IBEX 30 and RXR. For RXR specifically, we had these exercises going here in the United States up and down the East Coast called littoral or literal exercises, LEXs, 1 through 4, that we started testing out tactics, procedures, and really taking the core elements of reconnaissance or counter-reconnaissance and put it into action. So it was really good. So, but about 10 months ago now, the fleet commander in 6th Fleet, Admiral Black, Vice Admiral Black, was faced with both a challenge and an opportunity. And that's tied to the fact that for the last 10 to 15 years, maybe even longer, really since the beginning of the global war on terror, the 6th Fleet structure there in Naples, Italy, has not had to command and control an ARGMU, for a full deployment. Because usually those ARGMUs leaving the East Coast after a great 6-month workup and that amphibious ready group and the Marine Expeditionary Unit, you know, working together, they're very, very, I think, the nation's best trained crisis response force. They would basically sail right through the Mediterranean, right in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, and right into 5th Fleet, because 5th Fleet was focused. So this MU that's out there right now, with the flagship, the primary command ship that we were both on in Stockholm, you know, that MU was going to stay inside of EUCOM and AFRICOM primarily for its deployment. And so Admiral Black said, hey, what I really need to do is have a command control element in Naples in his headquarters to command and control the ARGMU, which also includes care and feeding and ship's maintenance and training and all those things. And so he asked my boss, General Journey, the MEF commander, hey, could we put together a command and control element to go over to command and control the ARGMU when it's in theater? Our boss and the commandant agreed to it, and we created Task Force 612. So 612 is the 6-1, just to make sure everyone's clear on this, is Task Force 6-1 is inside the task force construct in 6th Fleet, and 6-1 stands for Naval Amphibious Forces, Europe, and Africa. So, on a broader scale, Task Force 6-0 is the carrier strike group. Task Force 6-1 is Naval Expeditionary Forces. And then it just goes down the line to all the different kind of warfighting headquarters inside of a fleet headquarters. So basically, for that time in theater, we took on a Navy Admiral's, you know, blue flag that messed with a red Marine Corps flag to become 612. So it's 6-1 is Naval Amphibious Forces, and then 2 in this case was 2nd MARDIV. And so so that Task Force 612 was not directly tied to force design. It was more out of opportunity, but it became then the platform and the venue to do advanced exercises in theater for both our some of our IBEX forces and that RXR force. So below 612, we had RXR forces come forward, initially with the focus on continuing now in theater, you know, exercises, that Lex series exercise. We're just going to do one in theater to kind of prove out the concept and construct. But in the meantime, you know, the war in Ukraine increased Russian naval activity and, you know, jumped in there too. And that RXR force, and you met some of those Marines on the flight deck of the Kearsarge, you know, not only were we brought forward to exercise, we were brought forward to actually kind of prove the concept by increasing maritime domain awareness of the fleet commander. So I just wanted to kind of lay that out, because that's kind of the story, that 612 is not necessarily tied to force design. It's, you know, the Marine Corps being, as it always is, a very flexible force. We responded to a geographic command commander's requirements that came up from his fleet headquarters, that he had a command and control task that was going unfilled. And the Marine Corps filled it in kind of classic Marine Corps action. And it ended up working personality wise that I had worked with Admiral Black before when we were both one stars in Fifth Fleet. And I had Task Force 515, which again was Naval Amphibious Forces Central Command / Fifth MEB. And so Admiral Black, you know, knowing that we had that connection, I was here in the division working for the MEF, we could accelerate, you know, the stand-up of a headquarters because of that personal relationship, and hence was the birth of 612. So tied more towards need and responding to a request from a geographic command and a Navy fleet commander, and the personal relationship. But it became a venue and a platform for further experimentation for force design in the form of reconnaissance and counter-reconnaissance.
Can you talk a little bit about you know, about those kind of reconnaissance, counter-reconnaissance activities, and, you know, just how, like, you know, you're saying that that there wasn't a direct tie to Marine Corps 2030, but, or Force Design 2030, but the Pacific, I think there's a criticism out there that's a concept that maybe is geared towards the Pacific and not other theaters. But I'm curious if you found ways that it did fit in Europe, and maybe ways that it didn't. And if you feel like it kind of got fine-tuned in any way, if it worked differently in Europe for any reason. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And I do think, you know, on a larger kind of more macro scale, you know, I think Task Force 612, when you come into how we got there, but then the execution, it is tied to force design, because we are tied to increasing maritime domain awareness for a fleet commander. So it did platform out that way in the end. But I do think when we worked on reconnaissance, counter reconnaissance, we first got the task, and the division was tasked to lead this effort for the Marine Corps with the MEF, you know, our MEF kind of lead blocking force. You know, we want to make this theater agnostic, right? That it could apply anywhere. And matter of fact, Joe, I will tell you, I think the fact that we were able to go into UCOM and leverage Admiral Black's, you know, support, and he was very supportive of this, because I think he saw in the end that he would have increased maritime domain awareness, and so he was excited to kind of let us to take a swing at this thing. But we wanted to make it really the geography agnostic, you know, because really we're focused on that key maritime terrain that a fleet commander has to be able to execute local and temporal sea denial and sea control in. And whether that's the Pacific, or it's the Baltics, it's the Mediterranean, it's the Bab el-Mandeb, you know, it's the Persian Gulf, wherever it is, it's, you know, we are a maritime nation and our commerce has to transit those global commons that end up being those strategic choke points that have key maritime terrain. And so we worked very hard to ensure that what we were developing for reconnaissance, counter-reconnaissance could be exported anywhere. And I think it has great promise in the Pacific. But we thought, though, we have a better chance to exercise in the European continent, the European littorals, because often in the Pacific, you know, our legacy events there and our training there kind of put us in the same area, the same environment, and you're working with kind of the same partners. Here was a fresh canvas, you know, in Europe. And we were able to go in and engage the fleet staff that runs, you know, both EUCOM and AFRICOM naval littoral engagements and really kind of develop a campaign plan to test out RXR in a very active, complex theater to begin with. And then when you throw in the increased Russian naval activity, both in the Mediterranean and really primarily for us in the Baltics, you really had a chance to test this theory out. You know, go to those locations that represent those locations that fleet commander would have to be able to establish or reestablish, that sea denial, sea control temporally, that we want to operate in those areas, bring our forces in and enable that fleet commander's success. So it is very much exportable. I think the blank canvas of EUCOM was fantastic. The great fleet commander that supported the actions and so did his four-star JIFMC component commander was very much on board. And very quickly, what was started off as exercise experimentation said, can you go into this NATO country and actually do this mission? And the answer was absolutely. You know, so platform agnostic, in our eyes, geography agnostic. And because the focus is on key maritime terrain, and we got that in spades in the EUCOM AFRICOM theater.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit, like the unique terrain in Europe? I mean, I think, you know, it versus the Pacific, I think we, you know, maybe thinking of those waters as being more cluttered with commercial traffic, more cluttered spectrum wise. You know, maybe there are different concerns there. You know, the Baltic Sea, there's a lot of shallow waters and islands around Sweden. You know, can you talk about those, you know, those kind of key features and what, you know, what, you know, forces under the task force learned or what your takeaways were around some of that, you know, specific European terrain?
I appreciate it. It's a great question because if you look at, you know, what's interesting, if you compare and contrast, you know, the Pacific, you know, and which has large swathes of big blue ocean that eventually have to condense down into narrow choke points like the Straits of Malacca or the Sulu Sea and in and around the places that maritime traffic has to travel. You're absolutely right. From the Suez to the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus, to the Straits of Sicily, to Gibraltar, then all the way up to the Gulf of Finland, there's numerous opportunities to get into that key maritime terrain and then develop the axis and placement. So I think if the question really maybe might cycle around is that, what did we learn based on our experiments? So RXR, we knew right away, we didn't want to tie it to a certain wheeled vehicle or a certain platform because to be able to execute those operations, you have to have incredible flexibility and a dynamic approach. And so an example of this, Joe, would be that, you know, when we brought the RXR forces forward, we originally thought, well, we're going to get some C-17s. We have some UTVs, you know, those little kind of tan dune buggies you saw. You know, we got our radars mounted on there and some comm equipment. We have some aviation command and control systems, and off we go. Well, with the presidential directed actions of C-17 lifts moving to support the, you know, Ukrainian operations, you know, we lost all our C-17s. And so right away we're like, okay, well, how do we get to theater? Well, we pack up our stuff in Pelican cases and backpacks, and we get in commercial flights, and we fly into theater. And we did that. But being light and dynamic, you know, light and dynamic like that provides a lot of flexibility. And so we were able to land in a NATO country, and really within hours start actually increasing the maritime domain awareness of Sixth Fleet Commander just arriving on scene, because we're working with host nation forces, you know, and that in this phase of the operation or an exercise, we're in that literal contact layer. You know, this is where we believe, and the reconnaissance, counter reconnaissance fight is we're gonna have to win that fight in that literal contact layer if we expect to win in the blunt layer. So allies and partners are important. Operational preparation, the environment's important. You know, access and placement's important. So what we did, we're able to work with certain NATO allies and partners. So we didn't bring UTV. So we got rental cars. You know, one of our cables went down on one of our radars. What did we do? We went to a local boating store and got a new cable. You know, and we ate in their mess facilities. Now, that's now in the, you know, that would be a contact layer where all those things are up and running. You know, at the same time, though, we also were able, with our ARGMU that maneuvered up into the Baltic Sea, we were able to then link our RXR force to the ARGMU and leverage the V-22s, you know, the different mobility platforms, the ARGMU, with our ground-based RXR forces, and it ended up being kind of the perfect union, where all of a sudden we can then really put our teams. In one case, we had a radar team, and radars were part of it. The surface radars were part of it. Mm-hmm. That's also backed by a whole other structure of warfighting functions, primarily Intel Marines that were back at the fleet headquarters that are backstopping the effort forward. So we had that sensing force forward in those NATO countries, but we had kind of the mainline force working with the fleet headquarters that were providing the queuing and all those things. So it was a great synchronized effort. But once we linked to the ARGMU in with those RXR forces, we had then had much greater ability to go stretch our legs and end up, like you said, on those islands in those key locations. And that keeps the potential enemy guessing. They don't know where we're going to be, you know, and that's why we don't want to be a known entity in that contact layer. We want our radars, you know, blending in with the local noise. We want our intel communications to be passive. You know, we want to do that kind of reveal conceal thing on our terms, right? And so I think it's very different. So, you know, we can have, when the big gray ships are there, the fleet, they're there, that means one thing, but we can be there when they're not there. You know, and really what we really start to exercise is we keep, you know, let's say a DDG that can shoot an SM-6, you know, missile 100 nautical miles. We want them 100 nautical miles away potentially. And then we'll be forward, and, you know, in those areas and be able to bring those fires to bear if required. So I think those maritime choke points are so important. The lighter, more dynamic, more flexible you are, the more access we can develop into those different locations, build the right relationships. And then in some cases, you know, it might be very overt. In some cases, in other parts of the theater, you know, you have a clandestine approach, you know, where we're using different naval platforms to put forces ashore, you know, where they're least expected. So we had a full spectrum of capabilities, again, that we could offer. And we would then move those capabilities around in theater based on our best military advice to a fleet commander where we need to place them so they can take advantage of access and placement or key terrain and to increase his maritime domain awareness. And it worked really well.
I that's such an interesting example. I want to drill down a little bit, like how many Marines are we talking about? Like, what would those Marines, you know, normally be doing? You know, were there different teams of Marines doing different jobs, you know, for recon, counter recon? I wanted to drill down a little bit more about the folks you're talking about that are doing sensing or flying on, you know, flying commercially. Is there a way to break that down a little bit more?
Yeah, it's I don't have any kind of numbers in front of me, but I think the conceptual, right. It's if we looked at, you know, our primary two core elements of the tactical action armor for reconnaissance and counter-reconnaissance, those Marines and sailors came from 2nd Recon Battalion and our 2nd Light Armor Reconnaissance Battalion. So One of the force design changes or things that we're looking at hard in force design is the future of like wheeled vehicle reconnaissance. Very good in open desert, very good in open terrain, but can we look at that differently? And we're considering, you know, a second reconnaissance battalion, you know, provided the reconnaissance Marines that did some more what I call the hard skill work, you know, cold and wet, working submarines or working other surface platforms, working Zodiac boats, you know, clandestine actions at night, really, really good work. So that's kind of more classic Marine reconnaissance work. And I'm excited because we're getting back to classic Marine reconnaissance work we haven't done really in a long time, which is really good to see our recon Marines doing that. On the other side, as far as second light armor reconnaissance battalion, we developed an experimental mode, a mobile reconnaissance company with mobile reconnaissance team. So these are, you know, Marines with occupational specialties like the ones you met on the Kearsarge that, you know, might have been a communicator or an intel Marine or a mechanic or a scout on an LAV. We kind of looked at talent management. Who's best suited to do this? Who can operate in a smaller team? Who has real interest in making some of this these systems come together that might not have been designed to work together, right? And so what we ended up doing is mobile. We had four mobile reconnaissance teams, and that was the primary sensing force that was out there. And each of those teams were roughly 4 to 6 Marines and sailors, depending on kind of where they were in their construct. We had a headquarters element forward that was away from Naples, led by one of our O6s. He had a CTF. Then below that, this reconnaissance, counter reconnaissance element, the RXR element, was called a CTG, which is a commander task group 612-4. He ran the reconnaissance, counter reconnaissance efforts for 612, and he was forward. And he would then manage those teams forward. And then we had some other sensing elements forward doing different type of collections that, intel collections. And so that all combined, but that was our forward sensing force. The key was that all was brought back and fused in the fleet headquarters and with additional Marines that were working inside of the fleet headquarters with access to different systems with different classification levels. So that all together was recon, counter recon. So the total force investment going forward, I'm just kind of looking around the room here. I don't know, the total force investment, if you wanted to say CTF, CTG 612.4, probably 150 Marines total, Marines and sailors.
Right.
And that was spread between forward sensing forces and then inside the fleet headquarters that was driving the collection and increased maritime domain awareness. And then that team was also pushing back down to the forward sensing force indications and warnings and queuing and those kind of things.
And can you talk a little bit about a little bit about the equipment that, you know, these mobile reconnaissance teams, this is like a really defense news kind of question since a lot of our audience is industry focused. I think we're interested in kind of the types of equipment that these, you know, that Marines might have been using previously versus the kinds of things that they're using now. You know, you said at the outset that like before you came in there, some of the equipment that you might have been using, I guess we're probably talking about armored vehicles. That stuff isn't being used. So how did that change things? Or what kinds of equipment is being used now versus what was being used previously?
I think the overall methodology we applied to this was that, you know, it's equipment and it's capabilities, but it's really about logistics. In the sense, if you right. got to be able to get there, and you got to have the flexibility. So, the term small form factor was kind of our theme, right? And so I look at that. You know, if a small form factor, you know, we can kind of go down the path that, you know, we have. As a matter of fact, right now we have great, you know, communication systems. You know, backpack radios and the Harris system radios mm-hmm. that we have as program of record in the Marine Corps. You know, the PRC 150s, the 160s, really 117s, really good systems. we're able to leverage those systems and also apply a methodology to when to use them at the right time and place, so we're not exposing ourselves, and we're not revealing ourselves, and we're being smarter about how we're using our current systems. So that was kind of, one of our goals there. Vehicle, we originally wanted UTVs and those things just because it able to get us around quicker. And they are still very viable because they fit inside of a 53 or a V22, and they can extend our reach and speed. So, they still are viable. What's not viable is a larger vehicle that we would have to get strat lift or bring a ship in to move around. But we could do that too. If that was what was required, we would also do that, also. But so really, so if I look at small form factor, one of the key things for us was the ability to really tap into something called the Common Aviation Command and Control Systems, or CAC2S. And what's unique about that, and that's a great success story for our aviation counterparts in the Marine Corps, because, you look at that system and how do you link into the Link 16 network is really what that is. In the past, that would have been four or five Humvees and big radars and generators. This is, think about a couple of laptops and a couple of small, small scale, what we call Packstar type terminals that can fit in a backpack or really fit on, at least on a UTV. But that small form factor CAC2S was kind of the heart and soul of taking all the stuff we're collecting and entering into a process, a system that would then really eventually kick out, a Link 16 a linkage between us and supporting assets, whether that's an F-35 or a DDG, or providing our ability to link back into a fleet headquarters, into that maritime ops center, and having our location show up, in a COP. Those are all, Link 16 architecture is out there, and we found there's lots of different forms of it right now. But the how do we plug into it? Because that's the joint architecture. That's how you bring aviation fires and surface fires to bear. So I would say the small form factor of a CAC2S was key. Handheld Link 16 radios, they've been out for a number of years. Mm-hmm. We're able to acquire more of those and then bring that capability in also. We're able to use the Stalker UAS system. That's a kind of a program record for us right now. It belonged to the MU. We're able to bring it into theater and use that. That gave us about 100 nautical mile radius and longer loitering time and better collection equipment. So that was great. The other thing was initially our COTS off-the-shelf purchase or acquiring of a SIMRAD and FLIR radar systems that we were able to then link into that Link 16 system. That was the missing link, I should say, in the sense that no one ever had done that before. So you have these off-the-shelf radars that can, yes, acquire a target at sea and hook that track and bring it in. But it took those Marines you met a number of in this different littoral exercise to figure out how to connect it, and not just an air gap, but actually how to connect it into that CAC2 system. So then we could use it inside the Link architecture. So that's what was unique about this small form factor, light, mobile, very flexible forces, low numbers of very highly trained Marines that really train themselves too, specifically for this kit, and then get it right to that key maritime terrain. So that's how it kind of all came together. And then we're able to reinforce it with support from the fleet headquarters, and then mobility assets from the ARGMU, other supporting platforms across the task force in Sixth Fleet, kind of really enhanced what we're able to do in kind of that recon, counter recon. So I'll pause for a second. So anyone? Any questions there?
Yeah, I'm curious how much of it was, how much of it was, experimentation, use in exercises like vault ops versus were there any situations where Sixth Fleet said, hey, we need to, sort of from an operational perspective, like, hey, this is part of our mission here. We need to, we're monitoring, certain situations or you know, that extended beyond kind of the experimental or you know, exercise level?
I'll tell you, and we're looking around the room here and make sure we're clear on this, is that, as I mentioned earlier on, we came into theater with RXR. RXR wasn't tied to ball tops at all. You know, the ARG mule was tied to ball tops. And so, but in the end, think of, you know, as things developed over the time we were there with a lot more Russian naval forces out and about in the Baltic Sea, specifically in the Gulf of Finland, you know, and that's a normal transit lane for Russian naval forces in and out of St. Petersburg. So nothing new there. You know, we originally were going to do RXR in a different country. Once we got there, we were asked, hey, could you go to this NATO country and actually, you know, help increase the maritime domain awareness of the Sixth Fleet commander? And this was before Baltops. And the answer was yes, and that's exactly what we did. And so went past experimentation, and it went right into operational capability to be employed, you know, and not going to say everything's perfect. And we learned a lot each time we, you know, would adjust the force, move folks around, but it very directly increased the maritime domain awareness in key maritime terrain, you know, for that fleet commander before Baltops. And then what we were able to do, we realized there was goodness in including it in Baltops, and we were able to double down and assist there, keeping an eye on, you know, the increased Russian naval force presence and action in that area in the Gulf of Finland into the Baltic Sea.
Just to make sure that I understand, are we talking about the mobile reconnaissance teams? Is that when we're talking about sending forces, that to you're saying a NATO country? Are you able to say which country or?
I can't right now, Joe. I think just because just sensitivities of NATO and partnerships and all that.
Sure.
If you want our social media pages, you'll probably see, you know, where we were, and that might be a way to look at it.
Okay. Fair.
So we got time for one last question, and then the boss has to get going.
Okay. I just wanted to know, in terms of the one of the things that seems super interesting is the use of these forces for, or the use of Marines to do anti-submarine missions, which is like a mission that you don't think of Marines necessarily being involved with. Anything that you can say there about the kinds of activities that, whether you exercise them or, you know, had any kind of real world experience doing anti-submarine stuff?
You know, I think it's interesting. You know, I hear this a lot, you know, I think because the Commandant mentions anti-submarine warfare, and I think it's a bit of a misnomer in some cases. You know, the fleet tracking, you know, enemy or potential enemy submarines, you know, in their facilities and home ports, then at sea and all that, that happens all day long.
Right.
The key is that our RXR forces, if they're in key maritime terrain and they are executing that RXR mission, they are going to come across all forms and factors of potential enemy, you know, surface tracks and surface ships and maybe even submarines on the surface. I mean, so yes, that's I think what we're talking about. What we're talking about from a current RXR perspective, undersea ASW is obviously a different animal entirely. And, you know, there's some classification stuff I wouldn't talk about here, but I think our piece would be the RXR forces in 612 did assist overall in a theater-wide perspective of increasing maritime domain awareness, and in that maritime domain is submarines, you know, but the most effective submarine hunters are P-8s and DDGs, you know. And,
right.
But if we're in key maritime terrain where there's P-8s and DDGs operating, we can absolutely assist in further clarifying that picture. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, honestly, you know, even the ARGMU, you know, one of the things that we find submarines a lot is still by visual, you know, and MU aircraft flying around in theater, picking things up on the surface was also ASW in many ways. So So, you know, that's about as far as I can state that. There might be other programs the Commandant is involved in, I'm not, you know, part of, but as far as increasing maritime domain awareness for fleet commander in key maritime terrain, absolutely. You know, if we see it, we're going to report on it and we're going to track it, you know, and if it happens to be a submarine or a Russian intel collecting ship or a Russian surface combatant, we'll report on it and share the information, you know. And so we could and did participate in those overall RXR activities. And so I'd say yes, but probably not to, you know, not any way, shape or form of undersea warfare. Again,
got
I will
it.
Tell you,
okay.
we did have RXR forces on Navy submarines. And, you know, I'm very proud for the fact that, you know, it's known we had a team element on for 41 days straight on a Navy submarine. We haven't done that in a very long time. And, but that's assisting that submarine commander, you know, with his activities and then role reversal that, you know, then that sub commander would put our RXR forces ashore in key locations. And so that's our other connection to submarines.
What do the RXR forces do aboard a submarine for 41 days? Like what kinds of,
this is kind of our reintroduction to this environment. And so, you know, we got to, you know, figure out how to live on a submarine in close proximity,
right.
You know, launch and recover our small boats day and night, you know, on the surface, you know, and then work with that submarine CO and how we would actually insert and extract reconnaissance forces. And that's tied to RXR, but it's also tied to classic reconnaissance missions, you know, that this division and MEF does anyway.
Fair to say, like, this is about Navy integrate, greater Navy integration. And so the idea is to refamiliarize with kind of what Navy forces are doing, different Navy and putting Marines in positions maybe they haven't been in, you know, for a while, or?
I think it's overall, I think just to close it out, I think it's an overall,
yeah.
You know, really a 612 in general is about naval integration, you know, and I'm not saying return to our amphibious roots and all that stuff we kind of get involved in sometimes. You know, we were integrated inside of a fleet headquarters. You know, my boss during those 4 months for 612 was a fleet commander. Right. And I had my boss here back home, too, as a MEF commander. But the naval integration we're focused on, I believe in force design and RXR being one of the pillars of force design, is that if we do not assist the fleet commander in the early phases of a military campaign and we don't win the recon counter recon fight, we're not going to be able to introduce follow on Marine forces, you know.
Right.
And so I think, you know, we just demonstrated our ability to, in a very short period of time, synchronize with the fleet staff. Integrate with the fleet staff, provide a capability that increased the fleet commander's maritime domain awareness, and integrated and led the ARGMU as a CTF. So I think all those things together are naval integration in its purest form at a tactical level that ended up having operational and strategic consequences.
Right. All right. Well, I just to respect your time, I know you got to go, but if I've got, you know, follow-up questions, I hope I can kind of, you know, as I'm sort of trying to understand some of the specifics here, I hope I can follow up with, you know, with your team, with any other questions.
Yeah, no problem, Joe. You got Cassie here, and we also have Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Cummings in the room, and he has a lot of our unclassified, he can reach some of our unclassified RXR stuff. I mean, just some of the stuff we put out, and I think you have most of it, but you know, well, we can get that to you too. If you ask a question to Cassie, Cassie and Senator Cummins can talk about it, and we'll try to find some kind of proof source material of, you know, what exactly we achieved.
That'd be great. Yeah, I appreciate it. All right. Well,
yeah,
thanks so much for doing this.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thanks
care.
For your time.
Thank
out
you.
Here.
Bye-bye.
Recording stopped.